Paper 103, section 4, which is old single column, page 1133. As I alluded at the end last time, this next little section is not as little as it looks, actually. There, in a number of ways, are continuing on with the main theme thread that they were working with in the previous two sections that we were doing last week. You see where they're continuing to expand on the relationship between the fifth level of meaning and your initial developing, maturing relationship to the cosmos. That initial moral intuition that you're given is the real point at which you begin to leverage your way into relationship with greater things. You know, that's that initial point of contact that you begin to foster. And you'll see very definitively in this first paragraph how they tie that in directly to the levels of meaning. So you can see the whole picture where that initial relationship is meant to be headed as a first goal as you try to develop your relationship to the three cosmic intuitions. All right, who wants to take the reading here?
4. Spiritual communion. The characteristic difference between a social occasion and a religious gathering is that, in contrast with the secular, the religious is pervaded by the atmosphere of communion. In this way, human association generates a feeling of fellowship with the divine, and this is the beginning of group worship. Partaking of a common meal was the earliest type of social communion. And so did early religions provide that some portion of the ceremonial sacrifice should be eaten by the worshippers. Even in Christianity, the Lord's Supper retains this mode of communion. The atmosphere of the communion provides a refreshing and comforting period of truce in the conflict of the self-seeking ego with the altruistic urge of the indwelling spirit monitor. And this is the prelude to true worship, the practice of the presence of God, which eventuates in the emergence of the brotherhood of man.
As you mature in your relationship to the levels of meaning, maybe I should just remind you, remember the levels of meaning are not just one simple little thing. They're a general pattern of your initial mindful relationship to everything. I mean, they're the levels of meaning. You know, meaning is, you know, directly there in the domain of mind. And so it doesn't matter what subject you're talking about, you engage it initially through the levels of meaning. We talk about it over and over and over again because of that, because, you know, it keeps coming up in all sorts of different contexts. But as you begin to mature that relationship with the levels of meaning, you can engage them as a whole, elevate what started out as a hierarchical experience. You know, as you're moving up the levels of meaning, trying to transcend that initial very subjective relationship that you have to everything. When you reach the sixth level of meaning, you then can grab a hold of the whole, basically lift it all up and create a faceted cosmic structure out of it, you know, on a true plane of cosmic meaning. So we talked in the past about three of the examples where they point out those facets of cosmic expression of the levels of meaning. And it's one of those that is the real point of this paragraph. You notice, you know, the first thing they do is italicize the word communion. You know, even though it's right there in the title, they're wanting something extra out of you. What is it? It's this reflection on the facets of true mercy. Back there in paper 28, one of the great illustrations of directly the hierarchical levels of meaning. And in that same paragraph is one of the illustrations of the cosmic facets that can result from those. And that one is apropos to this. You know, the thread that's going through all this, you notice they mentioned altruism again, you know, the ego, altruistic back and forthing, you know, that we were talking about last week. You know, the main point here is what really results directly from that relationship with the fifth level of meaning, that moral discrimination. That is the facets of true mercy. True, remember, meaning, you know, it has cosmic character. And you notice right there, the fifth level of meaning has become the facet that's called spiritual communion. Now notice how they introduce this. You know, they start out with this little reminder that we all begin with the fifth adjutant. You know, initially it's just an energy of socialization, but you know, it begins to bud into an actual spirit of socialization that is really behind a social occasion. They're saying, okay, you all have that basic subjective starting point through the fifth adjutant, that spirit of counsel. What happens when you begin to bring in, you know, remember that's, you know, the fifth adjutant's here in the associative block. Okay. What happens when you begin to bring in more objective, associative consciousness? Because the second cosmic intuition, moral discrimination, that's in the associative block here too. There's the potential for that initial adjutant-based social consciousness to get elevated to a more objective character. And the most appropriate name to describe that is communion, in particular, spiritual communion, to remind you that we're talking about functioning with the Holy Spirit, that true spirit ministry, and using it to elevate the initial forms that you have in adjutant mind. So they go forward here and they say, in this way, human association generates a feeling of fellowship with the divine. And this is the beginning of group worship. We alluded to this before, right above the fifth level, the sixth level, that's established by the third cosmic intuition, your spiritual insight. So if you begin to actually bring your consciousness into that fifth level, as opposed to in the previous two sections, we were talking more about, well, it's up there and it's kind of luring us towards altruism, you know, which is being established by that second cosmic intuition. But now we're talking about more, well, let's follow that lure and begin to actually bring our consciousness in there. What do we find as we begin to insert ourselves into that fifth level of meaning? Well, immediately juxtaposed to it, I mean, immediately above it, is the sixth level. When you're going to create the cosmic facets out of these levels in this regard, that sixth level creates the facet of divine harmony. You know, think about it. There you are, and you engage that sixth level of meaning, the divine harmony, you know, this fellowship with the divine. You're turning your eye towards the cosmos, that harmony that is the cosmos, that divine harmony. And see, you're beginning to move into a relationship with the sixth level of meaning. Now, see, if you can get yourself up into that fifth, which like we said, it's the place that you most immediately engage because it's the associative block. It's where the mind is an associative phenomenon. That's where it, you know, immediately establishes a foothold. You know, and the moment you reach up, and grab the sixth, now you can begin to create a cosmic character. You can begin to elevate all that which you've ascended up through to get to the fifth level of meaning. So when they talk about the three cosmic intuitions, when they introduce them, and they talk about the three domains that they're related to, causation, duty, worship, and this is the beginning of group worship, see? True worship. As soon as you begin to engage that domain of the third cosmic intuition, true worship can come into play. All that initial, see, is just, you know, is meant to be understood in the context of the levels of meaning and their relationship to the three intuitions and the adjutants. And then they talk about how, you know, even primitive man began to have various socializations of this initial sense of communion. And social communion, you see, they purposely put the adjective there in front of it and talking about these simple things like, you know, the bread and wine. But the point is in the latter part, really, of the paragraph. The atmosphere of the communion provides a refreshing and comforting period of truce in the conflict of the self-seeking ego with the altruistic urge of the indwelling spirit monitor. Why? Why does it provide this refreshing and comforting period of truce? We visualized that when we imagined that we were taking the vantage point of our soul so that we could look over here and here's our self, you know, our adjutant mind self, and here's the cosmos. You know, we're kind of in the context, you know, you're looking up to the cosmos and down to the self. You know, if you turn away from the self and engage the cosmos, the ego is not in play. It's not going there, you know, you're just going to let go of that whole tension for as long as you are turned towards the cosmos. So that's all they're saying there. And then notice how they then point out this process of creating these cosmic facets. And this is the prelude to true worship, the practice of the presence of God. Yeah, sure enough, if you turn towards the cosmos, turn, put your consciousness in the sixth level of meaning, you've got that, which eventuates in the emergence of the brotherhood of man. So if you really engage the fifth and sixth levels like this, in this basic regard of you know, the level of mercy, the fifth level of meaning, which expands into a cosmic character of altruism. You know, if you're engaging it in that fashion, what kind of a structure are you going to build as you reach down from that starting point? You know, so you've got divine harmony and spiritual communion, and you reach down towards the fourth level of meaning. And what do you create with that fourth level of meaning? Fraternal fellowship. Okay, becomes one of the facets of true mercy. And then you reach down through the third level. Remember, you know, that's the neck of the hourglass. So you're always reaching through that, one way or the other. Here we're reaching down through the third and engaging the second. So that act of reaching through the third and grabbing the second creates a facet, see, based on two and three, mutual appreciation. The level of appreciation is the fifth level. What you've done, see, is you've taken that cosmic character of appreciation and you've brought it down to your fifth adjutant, down to the second level, the level of feelings, where the fifth adjutant is. And you've elevated what started as just this potential for a social occasion, and you've brought the objective character into relationship with it. And once you've engaged that, you can grab the first level of meaning, you know, in this full cosmic character and bring it into play too as this group understanding, you know, the spirit of understanding, the second adjutant in the first level of meaning. So now you have true group understanding. That's how you create these cosmic facets. And that's what they're describing here. Which eventuates, the which eventuates is once you grab a hold of 5 and 6 and you then reach down 4, 3, 2, 1, that eventually you grab a hold of it all the way down to 1, eventuates, in the emergence of the brotherhood of man. The brotherhood of man is fraternal fellowship, mutual appreciation, group understanding. There's three facets, basically, to the brotherhood of man. That whole paragraph is just a way of describing this process of moving beyond the mere hierarchical, you know, initial relationship with the levels of meaning, where you're first just, then fair, then patient, then kind, then merciful, then loving, where you're just engaging mercy in that initial hierarchical sense, and you're creating true mercy. A cosmic structure that involves all the facets elevated up into a cosmic structure. And you have the practice of the presence of God and the emergence of the brotherhood of man. That's where those come from, is doing this, taking this all the way to cosmic completion like that. That's why the brotherhood of man isn't something that just happens simplistically. It's a very complex process to get to the brotherhood of man. You start with just very, okay, you got to go all the way up. You know, and the brotherhood of man is what you get eventually after you go up and back down and lift it all up. It's a long process to achieve the brotherhood of man. You have to get everyone to go through this process of transcending their subjective character and establishing this real objective sense of mercy, true mercy, selflessness. Okay, just in passing. Like I pointed out, you know, the reason that 2 and 3 are together is because you're going top down to do this process. You notice you have a similar thing with the facets of personal responsibility. I mean, they're founded again, divine obligations 5 and 6 together, and then you're reaching down. And so, you know, you reach down through 3 to 2, so they're together again. You know, personal responsibility is a top down phenomenon. Coming from this spirit domain downward. But the facets of self-control, that's where you're consecrating yourself upward to the cosmos. That's a bottom-up consecration. The self is grounded below, and you're consecrating it upward. So in that one, see, you go through 3 to 4, and that's why 3 and 4 are together to create the facet in that one. And see, those are the two they bring up, you know, back there in paper 54 when they're talking about true and false liberty. You know, there's a very definite set of laws, if you will, you know, to this whole process of engaging the mind and the mind engaging, you know, reality. You know, it has these patterns. You know, you just look at the two word phrases and you go, well, okay, well, that's 2 and 3, maybe, you know, and then subsequently you know, oh, well, of course it's 2 and 3 because that's top down, or of course it's 3 and 4 because that's bottom up. You know, it always makes sense like that. The more you dig into it, the more you appreciate why it works that way.
When primitive man felt that his communion with God had been interrupted, he resorted to sacrifice of some kind in an effort to make atonement, to restore friendly relationship. The hunger and thirst for righteousness leads to the discovery of truth, and truth augments ideals, and this creates new problems for the individual religionists, for our ideals tend to grow by geometrical progression, while our ability to live up to them is enhanced only by arithmetical progression.
So you notice the key thing in the middle there, truth augments ideals. Truth is this flow that you engage. Where does that flow take you? If you go with it, you penetrate higher into the cosmos. And so it's going to augment ideals. The higher you penetrate as you follow truth upward, the higher ideals that you will begin to recognize. And like they're pointing out, that's a double-edged sword. One of the main things that this last little statement implies is that it's a given that your fondest hopes and dreams will be dashed. It's impossible for it to be any other way if you're human. Now, the fondest hopes and dreams of your animal consciousness can be achieved, but the fondest hopes and dreams of your human consciousness cannot be achieved. Because the moment that you are functioning as a true human, you have a growing separation between the geometrical and the arithmetic progression. If we start with 1, let's double it, you know, in a geometric progression. 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. 5 steps and we get to 32. Let's increase it in arithmetic progression. Start with 1. You got 3, 5, 7, 9, 11. Okay, so after 5 steps, arithmetically, you get to 11. After 5 steps, geometrically, you know, just using 2 as an example, you got to 32. Well, so after 5 steps, you know, there's a factor of 3 difference already. Let's say maybe, you know, each step represents a year. So after 5 years, you've got a factor of 3 difference between what you can achieve and what you can visualize through your sense of ideals. Okay, take it 5 more steps, you know, geometrically. 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024. Okay, and then arithmetically, you know, we were at 11, so 13, 15, 17, 19, 21. Okay, so after 10 steps, arithmetically we've gotten to 21, and geometrically we're at 1024. Now you have about a factor of 50. If we were saying that was the mathematics of your yearly progression. Well, after 10 years, you have a factor of 50 difference between what you can imagine in terms of an ideal and what you could ever achieve. If you, you know, establish what you think are your fondest hopes and dreams and you achieve them, you might want to think about just how great of an accomplishment that really is. See, by definition, that's an animal accomplishment. Fondest human hopes and dreams can't be achieved. It's just a good little way to reflect on that. It's almost like God has set me up to fail. No, you've got to recognize the mathematics of what's in play. Why could Lucifer do the demagogue shtick and have it work? Because, you know, all those beings he was talking to are just like you and I. They can see farther than they can do, you know? And so you can play that if you're a clever demagogue. You can play that differential to your own gain and their demise. The real power is not in the material. We always go to material examples. Material is not really dangerous. Monetary, so you lose all your money. It was never real in the first place. You haven't lost anything. Nothing of value is ever lost. So if it actually had value, it couldn't have been lost. But it was lost, therefore it does not really have value. The danger is, you know, losing that which is really of value. Gain the world, don't lose the money, but lose your soul. Again, you know, go to the relationship in the chart. You have ideas about things, and you have ideals about values. Again, it's just speaking to your conceptualization. Values are just objective. You know, matter, mind, spirit, quantitatively, that's objective. Things, meanings, and values, qualitatively, that's objective. But when you go to, you know, thinking about fact, truth, or goodness, or ideas, associations of ideas and ideals, you're talking about your mindal relationship to these things. You know, directly the relationship when you talk about fact, truth, and goodness. And then this kind of higher phenomenon of conceptualization. It's like, okay, I have these relationships. Now let me, you know, understand this, you know, as a concept. You know, it's a lot like the difference between the first three adjutants and the next three adjutants, where you go from in the moment to long term. You know, when you're going from a fact to an idea, you know, in the moment there's a fact. Okay, but then you're going to expand that, you know, into a long term relationship and have an idea about that fact. Okay, it's the same way with ideals. You know, there's a value. Okay, but I have an ideal associated with that value. You know, obviously in this context, it's what you're striving towards. And the way you do that is not by trying to let go of ideas and somehow reach up and grab ideals. You can't do that. You're not a spirit being. You're a material being. You have to look to the ideal, translate it downward, downstep it into an idea that's consecrated to that ideal, and then apply that idea, you know, in the material world, in your day-to-day life. And when you achieve a higher perspective of ideals about a given value, then you could say, well, is it appropriate? Yeah, I think it is. Let's try to create a new idea that's consecrated to this, you know, a little bit higher view I have, conceptualization I have of that value, you know, and then let's try to live by that, apply that idea. That's the basic difference. And you'll see they actually get to that right away in the next section. They mention that in passing. What's the dearest thing to you that you're going to lose? Your life. You're going to lose your mortal self. Every mortal self dies. You're going to lose it. There's nothing you can do to stop it. You're going to lose your mortal self. And you'll have lost everything, you know, if you haven't consecrated the adjuster to making a copy of that mortal self in Marantia substance so that it's not lost. If you haven't done that, if the adjuster hasn't copied yourself into a potentially immortal form and you die and that mortal self goes away and it's lost, was it of value? No, because nothing of value is ever lost. See, just think about what that means. See, by definition, it had no value. That's why it was lost. You have to choose to make it of value. And if you choose to make it of value, the adjuster will faithfully copy it. One other little passing comment about, you know, when you think about house, money, things like that, you know, they don't have value directly. There can be a relativity of value. You know, they aren't value, but they can sort of have value by association. You know, if they are part of the process towards greater things of value. But just, you know, remembering that, you know, they aren't innately value, so they can be lost. It's just whether or not you bring those things into relationships with value and give them meaning. Your house can have meaning, you know, money can have meaning, see, because it has an association with value. It isn't value itself, but it's in association with value, if you've done that, if you've consecrated that thing toward a value so that it, you give it meaning. Love is something that you do. You can't lose that. See, if you think of love as a noun instead of a verb, then you'll misunderstand it, and it'll seem like it's something that can be lost. You can fall out of love. No, see, that's a false use of the word love. You're using love as a noun. Love is not a noun. It's a verb. You either choose to love or you choose not to love. It's like, oh, well, then if it's a verb, of course it can't be lost. I mean, you know, it's up to me. I either do it or not. Now that post-Pentecost, I mean, everyone gets an adjuster at age 6, you know, and
some people don't live their life with God at all, and yet they seem to have love in their lives.
Again, I mean, you know, there's no iniquitous 6-year-olds. There's some faint little flickers of reality going on, at least early on, that the adjuster makes into a tiny little embryonic soul. And yes, a lot of people get too smart for their own good early on and put that whole process in suspended animation. You know, they don't go iniquitous and you know, evaporate that little embryonic soul. They just are clueless. Okay, and so that little embryonic soul is just cruising along in suspended animation for the rest of your mortal life. The adjuster's twiddling its thumbs, you know, waiting for something to happen, and nothing's happening. Planning for a million years from now because there's nothing better to do at the moment. So that person dies, and that little embryonic soul gets resurrected, and that great experience of waking up gets a lot of people's attention and gets the process going again. Oh, wow, I should maybe think about this. Yeah, you should have started a long time ago. But the thing that I was alluding to there's a subtle little thing. I mean, the difference between whether or not that soul is in suspended animation in spite of what you think you're up to. And they refer to that back in the previous paper, where they said, true, many apparently religious traits have grown out of non-religious roots. Man can intellectually deny God and yet be morally good, loyal, filial, honest, and even idealistic. Man may graft many purely humanistic branches onto his basic spiritual nature, and thus apparently prove his contentions in behalf of a godless religion. But such an experience is devoid of survival values, God-knowingness, and God-ascension. In order for the adjuster to make soul out of what you're doing, it has to be more than just morally good, loyal, filial, honest, and even idealistic. It has to have God as its nucleus. That choice must be there in advance. No matter how small and innocent and childlike that choice is, there has to be a choice of God. That's what gives the adjuster permission to do this. It's your free will. The adjuster can only do that which you give it permission to do through your free will. There has to be this, at least this basic childlike consecration to God, so that when you are loyal, it actually has survival value. You know, remember what they're talking about, survival value in you, the individual you. If you don't do that, that goes to the supreme. That, you know, exercise of loyalty or whatever, you know, becomes part of the supreme. We're talking about survival value in you, and that requires choice. Okay? And what did Jesus say? First, hell, have an advanced consciousness of the first 5 books of the Urantia book. And no, I mean, he didn't say that, you know. You must enter the kingdom of heaven as a child. You're given an initial inertia that will get this started. By grace alone, you're given this initial inertia. So in that initial innocent phase, you're doing what needs to be done, even though you're completely, you know, ignorant of it. You know, growth is never conscious, and it's really the case in that initial phase. You know, as a 6-year-old, I mean, you know, you have no sense of this, you know, really. But by grace alone, God has given it an initial character, you know, with an inertia that carries it, so the process gets started. But when you get to age 20, roughly, the age of choice, what does that represent? That's the point at which the initial inertia that you were given by grace begins to fade. And you have to start choosing for it to keep going. It's not going to go on forever. He didn't give it eternal inertia. He gave it about 20 years of inertia. And that's what they were, that passage I just read. See, that's why what was going on there can work. You know, you can seem to graft on this humanistic branch, and it seems to just work. Well, it's inertia. So those humanists are pointing to inertia and saying, see, you don't need a God. Yeah, well, watch it for a while. When the inertia starts to wind down, then we'll see how it's going for you. Because it will. It has a limited inertia. You got to remember, this is not a pure spiritual, you know, this is spirit engaged to matter. Matter, you know, is an inertial phenomenon. Everything that engages it has an inertia. It's very literal. One little thought to tie in, just trying to flip and find it. I couldn't see it immediately. But remember how we just read that line about how man always gives the name God to the highest ideal that he can conceive. I mean, that's the whole point. It doesn't have to be a clear understanding of the infinity and absoluteness of the first source and center of life. You know, it just has to be a line that's projected towards that as an innocent little child. You know, it doesn't penetrate very deep towards infinity, but it's worthy of being called God because it has the intent of God, of reaching God. Okay, and maybe it only gets to rocks, but it was intended to go to God. And the universe recognizes that. They don't judge it by how short the line is and only give it value if it makes it to infinity. One of the jobs of a parent is to nurture the child during that initial phase so that when they get to the point where they need to start recognizing what's going on and choosing to keep the inertia going, the first thing that child should do is step back, take a look. Oh, I see it. I see the line. Oh, okay, I can do that. I can keep that going. I mean, that's one of the reasons why that initial inertia is there too, besides just the simple fact that you know something's got to get you started. But it goes on for more than 5 minutes. It goes on for an extended period of time so that you can step back, you know, and you may need to, you know, scan across a number of years to pick it up because none of us are very discerning to start with. But that 20-year thread, you ought to be able to pick that up. I see it. I see that little childlike line of inertia. I can do that. You know, it's not putting any great demands. It's very simple. And God doesn't expect anything else. You know, he doesn't expect you to suddenly go zoom, you know, and ramp it way up. He wants you to just, you know, keep it going like that. If you keep it going in a true fashion, it will geometrically go by itself. Remember, man cannot cause growth, but he can supply favorable conditions. The favorable conditions are giving it the line that it needs. Then let the Supreme grow it. It'll happen automatically. I mean, the more you see these basic patterns we've been talking about tonight, the more you'll see, like I try to point out all the time, I mean, almost every sentence in the book, okay, speaks to this. We're trying to just get the recognition going so that you can begin to open up the truth of the revelation, you know, and you'll discover, just like that truth penetrates you higher and higher, you know, or deeper and deeper into greater and greater recognition of ideals, you know, it'll do that with everything in the book, too. Once you get that truth, you know, get yourself on that line of truth, every paragraph, every sentence will just continue to flower open on you into more and more meaning. Right, but what did Jesus say? Did he say, seek first a home? No, he said, seek first the kingdom of heaven. So you need to put God first. God needs to be the nucleus of your home. God needs to be the nucleus of your family. God needs to be the nucleus of your job. God has to come first, or all those things will eventually peter out and die. You know, you think, oh, no, I don't need God. They're just going along fine. What is that? That's that inertia. Don't be deceived thinking that it's just automatic. Okay, that's the inertia of grace, you know, that you're riding initially there. You're going to need to choose, and you're going to need God there. You have to engage the material world. Remember what they say, if you're actually ascending the cosmic levels, you know, ascending the psychic circles. If you move up, material success will follow, by definition. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, buckets of money. That isn't what, you know, the definition of material success. But, you know, in order to move up cosmically, you have to take the material and the spiritual and weave them together. So by definition, if you move up, there's going to be material success. But having material success doesn't move you up, because you may not have brought any spiritual character into relationship with that material sex. It may be just mere material success. Just like it may be just mere spiritual consciousness. Either one is just moving you, you know, to some extreme on the first cosmic level, on the seventh cosmic level, you know, the seventh psychic circle. You know, you haven't moved up. You have to have both together. All right, here, read a little bit here.
The sense of guilt, not the consciousness of sin, comes either from interrupted spiritual communion or from the lowering of one's moral ideals. Deliverance from such a predicament can only come through the realization that one's highest moral ideals are not necessarily synonymous with the will of God. Man cannot hope to live up to his highest ideals, but he can be true to his purpose of finding God and becoming more and more like him.
Okay, start up. Why do they have that parenthetical in there? Not the consciousness of sin. Because they're trying to remind you, you know, we're leaving behind the old definition of sin. It's not transgression of the taboos anymore. Okay? We're trying to get a true sense of sin. And we're not talking about that here. We're talking about guilt, which, you know, the old way of thinking about sin is when you experience guilt, that's an indicator that you've done something sinful. This is the old way of understanding this. You know, what the purpose, you know, even is of guilt. You know, that it's this little thing that God has put in your head to, you know, to remind you that you've just sinned. They're saying, no. What is guilt? Guilt is one of two things. It comes from interrupted spiritual communion. Okay, so in that old way of thinking, if that's what happened that led to the guilt, what kind of a sin would we have called that? We would have called that a sin of omission. Okay, what's going on? The interrupted spiritual communion. Here's the self, here's the cosmos. Okay, spiritual communion is when I'm engaging the cosmos. If I turn away, there's self, I'll feel a sense of guilt about that. See? That interrupted spiritual communion. I'm not doing something I could be doing. See, it's a sin of omission. Or from the lowering of one's moral ideals. You know, like we're pointing out, you can penetrate really deep. And, you know, you may rightly determine that that's too deep. You know, that's too high an ideal to be applied here. I need to, you know, apply a lower conception for this circumstance. And if you do that, even, you know, if it's the wise thing to do, you'll get that little tinge of guilt. You're like, you know, I could have consecrated myself higher. That's a sin of commission. That's those two types of sin. See, it's related to these two sparks for guilt. Now notice, you know, the next line there that should get your mere spiritual consciousness on edge. Deliverance from such a predicament can only come through the realization that one's highest moral ideals are not necessarily synonymous with the will of God. Your spiritual consciousness in and of itself would never have such a thought. Matter of fact, your spiritual consciousness in and of itself is going to reject that. You know, you blaspheme. And see, and they want you to have that reaction. Because it's should teach you something right off the bat. See, that you're not approaching this issue cosmically. And you need to mature that. You know, because if you think that it's only the highest ideal that is the will of God, it's going to be a very difficult life for you and for all those around you. Because that is, we do not live in Avona. Right? You know, that last sentence. Man cannot hope to live up to his highest ideals, but he can be true to his purpose of finding God and becoming more and more like him. We live in the super universe level, an evolutionary domain. You know, the definition of goodness is perfecting more and more like him, not perfect. But that initial false notion coming from your mere spiritual consciousness that goodness and perfect are synonyms gets you into this mode where you think that the will of God is only your highest ideal. No. You know, what is the will of God? Well, no, that's doing the will of God. I mean, the will of God is the Father's way. The will of the Father is the Father's way. And in the super universe level, what is that way? That way is cosmic. It is evolutionary. That's the Father's way. More and more, no matter how gradual, like Him. Sentence is meant to, it's got a twofold purpose, to challenge that old notion of sin, which becomes this horrendous boat anchor, you know, and even what comes subsequent. You know, the fourth epical revelation comes in to awaken your spiritual consciousness, but in and of itself, you know, there's going to be a tendency for it to just get into this mode, which is not really much better than what you had before. You've got to keep going through that spiritual awakening to a cosmic awakening so that you can begin to create a relationship between ideals and ideas that's wise. Mere spiritual consciousness is not wise in its relating of ideals to ideas. As a matter of fact, it has a tendency to reject the whole notion of ideas and just demand that there be ideals, that ideals be just actualized directly now. And that is impossible. And even worse, if you try to do that, it's going to produce the opposite effect to what you intended. All right, so that's what, you know, the point they're trying to make there. Okay, here, give us some more here.
Jesus swept away all of the ceremonials of sacrifice and atonement. He destroyed the basis of all this fictitious guilt and sense of isolation in the universe by declaring that man is a child of God. The creature-creator relationship was placed on a child-parent basis. God becomes a loving father to his mortal sons and daughters. All ceremonials not a legitimate part of such an intimate family relationship are forever abrogated. God the Father deals with man, his child, on the basis not of actual virtue or worthiness, but in recognition of the child's motivation, the creature purpose and intent. The relationship is one of parent-child association and is actuated by divine love.
See, in thinking about what I was just, you know, reminding us again about the perfecting perfect difference there of perspective. Now you appreciate all the more why Jesus chose, you know, to present the parent-child image to get you started in your understanding of what the relationship is. You know, a wise parent is patient with their child. They don't expect their two-year-old to be 40. They're patient and they're gentle and they nurture. You know, they strike step with you as you are. No matter how slow you might need to go to start with, that's just fine for the wise parent. The unwise parent, you know, is trying to, you know, somehow live vicariously through their child and shove them forward really fast so they can get their gratification that their low sense of self-worth, is needing. And there's no objectivity. There's no patience. That's why Jesus brought that analogy forward. Well, let's just move right in, because we've been talking about it so much here. This, the origin of ideals, they expand on that. It's obviously in play here, you know, because what we're talking about, they established in that opening paragraph with this creating these cosmic facets where you get a real grip on the objective domain and you reach down and begin to elevate, you know, that what was the lower part of the hourglass, that initial subjective domain that you were in. And so this whole relationship between ideals and ideas really starts to come into play. Once you really begin to get the subjective self and the objective cosmos to an interplay with one another, you've got to start really working on this. How do you translate ideals into ideas? There's this whole spectrum, sort of vertical spectrum of ideals, and there's this whole horizontal spectrum of ideas, and it's really complicated. It's just, there's nothing simple about it. You've got to figure out where to grab here and then where to place here, and that whole spectrum of ideas has nihilism on one end and magic land on the other end. And so without some wisdom, you know, some temperance, you know, you're going to have a tendency to slam it to one rail or the other. And it's very complex. There's always that, you know, next step of putting it into action. There's the thought, the word, and then the action. So you notice you have that threefold pattern in play with this process. Just like you have the thought God, the word God, and the God of action, you have the thought, word, and action that you have to go through. I talked before about the whole ability to validate that idea, you know, and get some positive feedback, and the adjusters, they're helping with that, and you know, all that stuff comes into play. All right.
5. The origin of ideals. The early evolutionary mind gives origin to a feeling of social duty and moral obligation derived chiefly from emotional fear. The more positive urge of social service and the idealism of altruism are derived from the direct impulse of the divine spirit indwelling the human mind. This ideal of doing good to others, the impulse to deny the ego something for the benefit of one's neighbor, is very circumscribed at first.
Maybe just before we read any deeper, just you know, you notice in passing, they're using that, you know, as a hyphenated construct, idea, ideal. You know, reminding you just what I was saying. You have to bring them into association. You notice, I mean, it's not just the ideal of goodness. It's the ideal of doing good to others. It's one thing to have conception of the ideal of goodness, but how do you actually, you know, formulate an idea about actually, how would you actually do that? You got to have some idea about how you would actually do it. And then you have to actually accomplish that. It's a multi-step process. And maybe just also notice these the first paragraph here and the last paragraph in the previous, there's a little twofold reminder that, you know, you're starting, you know, the zeroth level of meaning is a level of fear. And so, like they mentioned, it's, you know, even if you get a glimpse up there to the fifth level of meaning, your feet are planted down there in the subjective domain on the zeroth level of meaning, fear, the level of fear. It's all rooted in fear to start with. But you know, you're not consigned there for all eternity because of what they said in that last line of the previous paragraph. The relationship is one of parent-child association, and it is actuated, you know, it's set in motion by divine love. You know, that spiritual gravity is reaching down and is going to try to pull you up unless you absolutely reject it. Eventually, it's going to lift you up enough that you can flip your feet around and plant them firmly on the cosmos instead of on fear. All right.
Primitive man regards as neighbor only those very close to him, those who treat him neighborly. As religious civilization advances, one's neighbor expands in concept to embrace the clan, the tribe, the nation. And then Jesus enlarged the neighbor scope to embrace the whole of humanity, even that we should love our enemies. And there is something inside of every normal human being that tells him this teaching is moral. Right. Even those who practice this ideal least admit that it is right in theory. All men recognize the morality of this universal human urge to be unselfish and altruistic. The humanist ascribes the origin of this urge to the natural working of the material mind. The religionist more correctly recognizes that the truly unselfish drive of mortal mind is in response to the inner spirit leadings of the thought adjuster.
Okay, and just remember the full perspective there. Don't think of it just simplistically as some little magic wand thing that the adjuster does. You know, there's a whole structure that's put in place to make this happen. You know, and the key is that encirclement in the Holy Spirit, you know, so that when they say, and there is something inside of every normal human being that tells him this teaching is moral, right? Well, the basic mechanism is what? It's your moral discrimination, your second cosmic intuition, your ability to know right and wrong, to distinguish right from wrong. Okay, so you have that basic mechanism, and then the adjuster coming in, universally post-Pentecost, the adjuster is coming in, catalyzing your relationship with that second cosmic intuition, which is, you know, the point they're making there. Like I said, I mean, most of the time, they're speaking in this post-Pentecost context where everyone has an adjuster, you know, that's wholly blended into the process with, you know, and engaging your relationship to the Holy Spirit. So he's a, you know, the adjuster is an intimate part of the process. It's just over and over, they're focusing on, you know, the significance of that fifth level of meaning, you know, the second cosmic intuition as your initial engagement point. And then everything is leveraged off of that initial fulcrum.
But man's interpretation of these early conflicts between the ego will and the other than self will is not always dependable. Only a fairly well-unified personality can arbitrate the multiform contentions of the ego cravings and the budding social consciousness. The self has rights as well as one's neighbors. Neither has exclusive claims upon the attention and service of the individual. Failure to resolve this problem gives origin to the earliest type of human guilt feelings.
Notice they even reminded you of the relationship between the zeroth and the first level of meaning there. The zeroth level, you know, with mechanical mind, just establishes individuality. And then when, you know, agitant mind comes in and establishes the first level of meaning, then there's a rudimentary self. So, and you notice how they're, you know, talking about that relation. The self has rights, you know, relative to the individual. So they're actually distinguishing that differential between the first and the zeroth level of meaning there even. So they're being very precise in how they're, you know, getting you to picture all this.
Human happiness is achieved only when the ego desire of the self and the altruistic urge of the higher self, divine spirit, are coordinated and reconciled by the unified will of the integrating and supervising personality. The mind of evolutionary man is ever confronted with the intricate problem of refereeing the contest between the natural expansion of emotional impulses and the moral growth of unselfish urges predicated on spiritual insight, genuine religious reflection.
That's an interesting variable. I mean, you may not have really thought of yourself in that role before, but notice the role they just put you in there. You're the referee between your mortal self and your soul? No. You know, they very carefully made sure you weren't thinking that the higher self, you know, that they refer to there in that first sentence is your soul. No. We're talking about the self of the adjuster. The adjuster has a self, not a person, but has a self. See, there's two selves, the adjuster self and your mortal self. And you're standing over here on what initially, you know, you're initially, like we pointed out, your soul is not really a very active phenomenon. It's more just a place where you can stand objectively to start with. You know, you don't have Marantia mind. It isn't really active and engaged in anything. It's just, you know, in an embryonic stage to start with. But it is a vantage point from which you can be this referee. You know, and you have to coordinate this relationship. The adjuster is subservient to your will. So you're in charge. The adjuster is imprisoned. Remember, they use the word imprisoned itself in your mind. Your boss. I mean, you got an awesome responsibility here, you know. It's not just going to magically wave its wand and fix you. You have to say, okay, now you're going to do this, but hold off on that. I'm not ready for that yet. Now self, you need to, you know, you've got to engage this and think about it very literally. You're in charge of this whole coordination here. Those first 20 years, the fragment has been a thought changer, and it's gotten you ready to be able to engage this process. And then for the next 20 years, roughly, you know, it's a thought adjuster, and it's adjusting, you know, trying to help you, you know, with this. You know, and eventually you get it all set up to the point where the adjuster can become a thought controller instead of just an adjuster. The adjuster is going to make decisions relative to yourself. But you've made the choices, you know, you've fully consecrated through choice as a person, you know, with your personality, to set this up so that it's all right. Okay, now, and then you can say, adjuster, go for it. Become a thought controller. See, again, it can't do that until you choose to set it up properly. You know, and then it will start to really flow. You brought up, you know, the exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with God. See, this is what you mean by that, you know, doing the will of God. So when you go internal like this, you know, are you sharing that inner life with God, the adjuster? Are you dealing with them both, you know, the two selves? Are you sharing the inner life? Or is there just yourself? You know, the inner universe is only big enough for you. You know, so there's no exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with that other self. Are you willing to share that inner domain with another self? Or are you selfish? Once you're sharing, every once in a while you can just, okay, let's just forget about this self for a moment and let me just commune with the cosmos. And my adjuster, you know, is a very solid focus point of the cosmos into my mind. You know, so it makes this process of spiritual communion all the more direct. You know, again, it's a catalyst for all these sorts of things. See, it'll catalyze that spiritual communion. It's like, okay, let me just commune with the divine self here. Okay, now I'm ready to take up the challenge again.
The attempt to secure equal good for the self and for the greatest number of other selves presents a problem which cannot always be satisfactorily resolved in a time-space frame. Given an eternal life, such antagonisms can be worked out, but in one short human life they are incapable of solution. Jesus referred to such a paradox when he said, "Whosoever shall save his life shall lose it, but whosoever shall lose his life for the sake of the kingdom shall find it." The pursuit of the ideal, the striving to be godlike, is a continuous effort before death and after. The life after death is no different in the essentials than the mortal existence. Everything we do in this life which is good contributes directly to the enhancement of the future life. Real religion does not foster moral indolence and spiritual laziness by encouraging the vain hope of having all the virtues of a noble character bestowed upon one as a result of passing through the portals of natural death. True religion does not belittle man's efforts to progress during the mortal lease on life. Every mortal gain is a direct contribution to the enrichment of the first stages of the immortal survival experience. It is fatal to man's idealism when he is taught that all of his altruistic impulses are merely the development of his natural herd instincts. But he is ennobled and mightily energized when he learns that these higher urges of his soul emanate from the spiritual forces that indwell his mortal mind.
And there's a couple little things, you know, in between the lines there. One, you know, the herd instincts. In other words, you know, that humanist is really, see, just pointing to the fifth adjutant, inherent gregarious nature that comes from the spirit of socialization. He's thinking that the mind is just natural, you know, and basically he's recognizing that that's the fifth adjutant is there, even though he doesn't know it, and pointing to that. But notice again, you know, this refers to that inertia thing we were talking about. It is fatal to man's idealism. If you think that it's just natural, you think that inertia is eternal. Yeah, that you're self-actualizing and self-sustaining, you know, is the beginning of the descent, you know, in the Lucifer Manifesto. But, you know, they're trying to point out it's not the way it works. It's like I was saying, there's an inertia here, but it's not inherently and eternal. You've got to get involved. The excitement, you should have no hesitancy of getting involved. I mean, it should be so exciting to you that you've been given all of the gifts that you need. All you have to do is just engage it and start going. It's, you know, you don't have to make some great journey across continents or anything. It's all right there within you. And that should be really thrilling, exciting, that when you need to, you know, when you start getting past 20, you know, and it's time for you to be a little bit more about the Father's business, you know, you should be excited to just start working at it, you know, with no worry that you have to be perfect right from the start. It's a parent-child relationship. God doesn't expect you to be perfect in your first try. He wants you to just get going and have fun with it. The religion papers are definitely meant to, you know, it's like, let's set aside all the details for a moment. Let's get up there and get a real solid picture of the real nature of the whole religious domain, how it connects into everything, and what the full scope of it is. Okay, now let's try to be about the Father's business. Let's try to engage all these details, and let's look to Jesus' life and teachings for some guidance, and we can actually use that now because we have the big picture before we try to understand all the details, you know, in the Jesus papers. So we have things in the right order. You know, we've sought first the kingdom of heaven, and then we're going to work on the details. You know, those details don't have what they need in and of themselves. And what do they need? Do they need more details? No. They need something from above brought down. You have to seek first the kingdom of heaven. All right.
It lifts man out of himself and beyond himself when he once fully realizes that there lives and strives within him something which is eternal and divine. And so it is that a living faith in the superhuman origin of our ideals validates our belief that we are the sons of God, and makes real our altruistic convictions, the feelings of the brotherhood of man. Man in his spiritual domain does have a free will, Mortal man is neither a helpless slave of the inflexible sovereignty of an all-powerful God, nor the victim of the hopeless fatality of a mechanistic cosmic determinism. Man is most truly the architect of his own eternal destiny.
There's a good example. We've talked about this a lot, the difference between free will and self-assertion. Man, in his spiritual domain, does have free will. Not in the domain of mind. In the spiritual domain, you have free will. Even in relationship to ideals and ideas, you have free will to engage an ideal, but in the process of trying to translate down to an idea, and especially in trying to put that idea into action, all kinds of things can step in and stop you. The moment you bring it down into mind, and then especially when you try to bring it out into matter, you don't have free will there. All sorts of things can intervene, and you have to take that into account, if you're going to have any modicum of success. It's just very important, once you take it from the personality down to the self, you've got to deal with other selves. If you don't keep those separate, that's where the dangers that go towards Lucifer come into play. Free will and self-assertion are very different things.
But man is not saved or ennobled by pressure. Spirit growth springs from within the evolving soul. Pressure may deform the personality, but it never stimulates growth. Even educational pressure is only negatively helpful in that it may aid in the prevention of disastrous experiences. Spiritual growth is greatest where all external pressures are at a minimum. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Man develops best when the pressures of home, community, church, and state are least. But this must not be construed as meaning that there is no place in a progressive society for home, social institutions, church, and state.
Note at the beginning there, besides the final thing about don't immediately interpret it in flatland as a dichotomy, but, in the beginning part, again, they're reminding you of what? Man cannot cause growth, but he can supply favorable conditions. And notice how they gave you a little bit more of an understanding, direct understanding of why. See, notice how they worded that. Spiritual growth springs from within the evolving soul. You aren't really in there yet. Your self is an agitated mind. You haven't transferred the seat of your consciousness over to your soul and engaged Marantia mind. The Supreme is engaging the soul. The oversoul of creation is engaging the soul. The Supreme grows you. You don't grow. The oversoul is engaging your soul, and growth is welling up from within it. See, so it's not coming from you. You're not at the center of that process. The Supreme is. So they're just giving you a little bit, of a direct way to understand why it is that man cannot cause growth. But you can supply favorable conditions, like not putting a tight clamp on that soul so that it can't expand. You have absolute free will, so you could say no. It's a binary choice, yes or no. And if you say no, that's it. It's an absolute no. And the Supreme is can't grow against that free will choice.
When a member of a social religious group has complied with the requirements of such a group, he should be encouraged to enjoy religious liberty in the full expression of his own personal interpretation of the truths of religious belief and the facts of religious experience. The security of a religious group depends on spiritual unity, not on theological uniformity. A religious group should be able to enjoy the liberty of free thinking without having to become free thinkers. There is great hope for any church that worships the living God, validates the brotherhood of man, and dares to remove all creedal pressure from its members.
Okay. And of course, not just church, but state also. Now, Gene brought this up. Notice they're referring to this. A religious group should be able to enjoy the liberty of free thinking without having to become, quote-unquote, free thinkers. Now, if you aren't all aware, free thinker is a technical term now. What does it mean? What's the distinction between, the liberty of free thinking and, quote-unquote, free thinkers? Okay, it goes to the Lucifer Rebellion, and that greatest problem that resulted from the Lucifer Rebellion. The inability to distinguish between true and false liberty. They're reminding you here of what we've talked about a number of times, in getting a cosmic understanding of liberty, not just that mere immature spiritual notion of liberty, because it needs to be true liberty. Spiritual consciousness alone can't make it true. Only cosmic consciousness can make it true. What's the key here? The realization through your growing cosmic consciousness that you can have liberty within form. There is no such thing. It's delusional to think that there is liberty without personal responsibility and self-control. You know, we're just reminding ourselves of those. This full cosmic facets of self-control and these full cosmic facets of personal responsibility are essential, you know, are indispensable to the realization of true liberty. Okay, if you think that you can have liberty without form, that's a free thinker, quote unquote. Welcome to the Lucifer Rebellion. That is the essential sophistry of the Lucifer Rebellion. What was the battle cry of the Lucifer Rebellion? The battle cry was self-assertion. Was the battle cry of the Lucifer Rebellion. We've been touching upon this all, you know, it's all come to a point right at the end here. That's why we've been touching this lightly, you know, several times as we've been going along the whole night. It's coming to this focus point, remembering what's in play. If you don't distinguish personality and self, you know, all these various things, if you don't have a clear differentiation of what's in play, you're not going to distinguish true and false liberty, and you've fallen into the greatest problem. You know, the moment that you declare yourself to be a free thinker, that form is evil, you now see this, and you are going to have liberty without form, you've joined the Lucifer Rebellion. You know, even if you have you've never heard the name Lucifer, you have no notion of this, that's what you've done. You've joined the Lucifer Rebellion the moment that you think that. There's great danger in play. You know, that's why we so carefully, you know, went through. That's why they laid it out so carefully and we so carefully went through it. You know, so they remind you as that bottom line at the end there. You have very limited, you know, ability to exercise absolute free will. I mean, there's relative, you know, you can translate that free will down into the self, and so there's a relative, but, you know, it is what they said. Man is most truly the architect of his own eternal destiny. You have absolute free will to choose between eternity and oblivion. Everything else is relative. And you're going to have to deal with other selves, and things can get in the way, and blah, 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 blah. But free will, you know, in a pure absolute sense, is only about eternity. Everything else, you know, is having to be downstepped and has to deal with all these other issues. And one of the first things that it has to deal with is that self that wants to assert, you know, that incessant clamoring of inescapable self for recognition and honor. That's just the way it's wound up. One of the very first things that you've got to deal with is this first cosmic pattern here of self-control. You need to get that self under control by clearly getting the cosmos in view and getting it synced up with it, you know, so that there's it's consecrated to spiritual values and moral duty. And it begins to manifest social forbearance, intellectual fairness, and material justice. That's a controlled self. Now, next time, we shift gears a little bit. We're going to get into a higher level discussion of the relationship between science and religion. The philosophic coordination, what's being coordinated, science and religion. You know, that's where it initially is here. You have philosophy and the associative block between science and religion. They're going to spend an extended period here now, really fleshing out that part of the picture.